Today on the Mike O'Mara Show.
The ketchup is really strong.
Well, it's Heinz, so I'm going to use that. All right, I'm going to go.
Mike, what's the brand of ketchup that you served at O'Mara's?
House recipe, Rob.
That's why we failed.
It
kind of gets to that in all conflicts. We're the dominant people. We need to. That belongs to us. There's a hubris there that is interesting to watch.
The motto back then, Mike, was "Make Japan Great Again." Is what they had hats.
They had red hats. They were going to rallies. My cranberry sauce is standalone. And by the way, I make it from scratch every Thanksgiving. And thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, I know it's easy.
Big Cranberry salutes you, Mike. Show them your Ocean Spray medal.
F you and your families, too.
All that and more. The Mike O'Mara Show starts now. Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment. You can listen to The Mike O'Mara Show at MikeO'MaraShow.com.
Well, what have we here?
It's a podcast.
Fine.
And what excitement we have today.
It's The Mike O'Mara Show with Mike O'Mara and Rob Spiewak. Now, here's Mike.
Would I be accurate in saying I'm hearing all sorts of bounce back and stuff like that? Is it weird?
You opened up two browsers.
A second.
Let me close your other browser.
Thank you.
Mike loves to browse.
You confused
back, Mike.
Me because two videos popped up during the countdown.
I know. Something happened right at the beginning. Welcome to the Mike O'Mara Show, everybody. We are glad to have you along. And I'll let you do everything, Josh, if you want, or unless you want me to press any buttons, you just let me know.
I already kicked you out of the studio, so if you're still hearing something, it's on your end.
Okay, I hear something. All right, so I'm going to come back here. I'm going to get rid of that.
All we have to do is hit some buttons. It's great to have Mike back. Mike, I appreciate your job after having to do it yesterday.
Uh-huh.
It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here. It's always great to be here. We're just having a little issue here.
So are you using the TRS-80 today?
I believe you probably have the show open in another browser.
I think you're absolutely. Oh, there it is. Okay.
And then,
Why you're hearing double.
Off to the races.
Right. I'm just going to be popping on things until I get rid of it. Welcome to the show. Yeah, I'm back from my little medical procedure that we had yesterday, and I am telling you, I believe even within 24 hours that it is an overwhelming success.
And he's gone.
And he closed. He said he was going to keep clicking on things until it went away. And
well,
it went
I'm
away.
Sure that he's not getting any doubled audio now.
Right.
Because he's gone. So, Josh, while
welcome
he comes back.
Back.
Welcome back, everybody. You're in Baltimore. You are in your sister's basement right now?
I am. Yep, I'm staying at my sister's home. All right, and we've got Mike back.
Let's start the show. We're going to have some fun right now because supper time, reading time, and boy... This is exciting. I've been really looking forward to talking to this author. His name is Ronald Drabkin, and the book is Beverly Hills Spy, and it is a story. You don't have to hold it up to.
I think it looks nice. It's
I know
parallel.
That's you really don't have to hold it up to. I mean, I don't understand that.
Not trying to step on any toes here, Mike.
Okay.
Just making
well,
a
you
presentation.
Just did, but that's okay.
Disagree.
All the way from Tokyo, and it is appropriate because this book is about the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor, and there's really nothing I don't like about this book, and I have so many questions I really don't know where to begin. This book, even though it is not a massive book, it is, in my opinion, a bit of an epic. Because it follows an individual, Frederick Rutland, who was a double agent. And let's bring in Ronald Drabkin right now. Hello, Ronald, joining us all the way from Tokyo, Japan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Mike.
This book, first of all, I think having a father who served in the South Pacific makes me more sensitive to this material. And so much has been written and so much has been documented about the attack on December 7th, 1941 of Pearl Harbor. But this is a story that I don't believe has ever been told. And I think I will begin by the story of, I'm not giving anything away when I talk about it, it centers around this war hero from World War I, whose name was Frederick Rutland, and his journey and his story about how he became associated with the Japanese Navy and how ultimately he became a spy for Japan leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor. So much has been written up until this point, and the stories have been told, Ronald, up until this point about the lead up to Pearl Harbor. And the only thing that I had before I read this book in my mind was that there were failures on multiple levels in the lead up to the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. Some people thought, everybody in general thought that there was an imminent conflict at that point. But as far as the attack itself, there's controversy surrounding how it happened and why we didn't know it was coming. And enter this story. And this is a story that I don't believe has ever been told. And how did you discover it?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was checking with the FBI. And I was checking with the FBI because, well, as you probably know, Mike, anyone could check with the FBI and say, hey, do you have any documents on some person, right? And if they have them and they're declassified, they'll tell you. My dad had been a spook, you know, growing up, never really knew that much about it. Obviously, didn't talk about it too much. I knew he was chasing communists around Southern California.
And your grandfather, but, too, right? Your grandfather
had been? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the intelligence business.
Mm-hmm. In the intelligence business, working for the U.S., thank God. But yeah, anyway, when Dad passed away and I found some of these files in his house, I thought, you know, gee, I want to learn a little more about this. You know, I was thinking maybe I'd find some, like, dead bodies in the crawl space of the house. But there was nothing there. So, yeah, I wrote to the FBI. I didn't get that much. And I started writing a little bit more to the FBI and saying, do you have files on this? And you know how it works is when the FBI, when they declassify something, they don't like tell the world, hey, we just declassified something really hot here, right?
Right.
Right. They just like, you said, you have something on this? And they go, yes, here you go. And so I'd asked about this. I was like, oh, a British guy who was spying for Japan in Hollywood. Right. That's interesting. Do you have anything on that? And it came back and it had been recently declassified. And I'm like, wow. I got a story here.
Can I ask you a question about declassification? This is fascinating. Yeah. Is it based on an amount of time, a set amount of time that has passed, or the subject matter?
Great question.
How do they determine what is declassified at the FBI?
You know, I don't think they tell you. Well, I know they don't tell you everything, but I can tell you they're going to wait until there's no one who was alive then, like who would be in the files.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Which means that, like, World War II, a lot of stuff around World War II has actually come and declassified now.
Right.
Okay. I will tell you that a takeaway from this book, and not an overwhelming takeaway because it's not focused on throughout the book, but he comes in and out. J. Edgar Hoover, man. I mean, that guy, you know, wrong side of history again. And yeah. And tell me what you think of nothing disproved my feelings about J. Edgar Hoover other than a power broker, paranoid. His number one goal was making the Bureau look as good as possible.
Yeah.
And just covering his own ass at every turn. Would that be accurate from your research?
100%.
Yeah. It was just stunning. And cooperation between agencies plays a major part, specifically the ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, now known as NCIS, and the FBI. And yeah. I think for as long as we have followed subjects like this, cooperation between agencies quite often is problematic, whether it's crime solving, whether it's military intelligence, and certainly this story of following this, who turned out to be a double agent,
right.
This is no exception. That was one of the biggest problems in this. And in this case, three, where you had MI5 and MI6 in Britain following Frederick Rutland. That certainly helped his cause, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, like, what do you call it? Slipping between the cracks.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And a specific question when I was reading this, and I didn't get too far into the book before I had this question for you. The amount, because it starts in World War One, where Frederick Rutland is a war hero, and then takes you all the way up through, I won't give away the ending. That would be terrible. But I will say that it covers a lot of years. And one of the things that amazed me was how many things this guy was into after his service in the Royal Navy, and how much travel for that time of history did.
Oh, murder. Had to be murder, right?
London, Hollywood, Japan. That could not have been easy to do, Ronald, back in those days, and time-consuming, I would think. You get through that really quickly in the book, which I think enhances the book a lot.
Yeah. First-class travel on the ships, right?
The paid more by the Japanese Navy a lot of the time, right?
Yeah.
Let's get to the because he's into so many things. Do you think that his driving motivation was either money or was it money or was it power or fame? What do you think motivated this guy? Because he was a bad guy, as you admit. Yeah. It's just a question of what was the driving force between this guy, in your opinion, with Frederick Rutland?
Yeah, I'd say it was like ego and being in the game was number one. And that's true for a lot of people, you know. Like, I worked in Silicon Valley a long time.
Ego.
It's about the money, but it's also about being in the game and being important and having people listen to you and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's
passed
wild.
Over. Go ahead, Rob. I'm sorry.
I was going to say it's wild to me that this is the first World War II spy book I've read that included Boris Karloff as sort of a character.
That's right, that's probably what you.
So
got.
He probably. I mean, he liked to run with the run with the Hollywood types too, right?
I mean, who? What a great cover, right?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
He liked he liked being in Hollywood. He liked having the big house. He gets. If you could just tell us how he got involved with Japan to start with, because back in those days, when you're talking about the 20s and 30s, it's just amazing that the travel involved in this, how it happened.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the fellow Frederick Rutland was a low class kid in England. Grew up. His dad was a day laborer, right? The lowest of the low. He entered the Royal Navy age 14, at about 5'3" and 75, 80 pounds, you know, underfed, and was just a very, very talented guy. He worked his way up to become a pilot and an officer. That didn't happen very often, right?
Right.
And a big war hero in World War One. He was the first guy to fly an airplane in naval combat, you know, right off a ship in 1916, you know, brave guy. And, you know, they always talk about how the guys who are heroes during war don't do as well during the peace, you know?
Right, right.
You saw this movie Rambo way back when? It's kind of about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of true. And after the war was over, you know, he thought he was a hero. He was going to get promoted in the new Royal Air Force. And, you know, they just didn't like him there. They're like, you know, you're a low class dude. I mean, they didn't say it in these words, but, you know, you're a low class dude. You're kind of abrasive. You've been sleeping with the other officer's wife and you're not going to get promoted. Right.
Right.
And by the way, you were allowed to sleep around as a British officer back then. Just not, you know, you need to keep a little on the down low, right?
A little decorum.
Not with a fellow officer.
Yeah, Mike, your bragging, Mike. Sorry. Come on.
Mm-hmm. He's doing that, and he's also, it's the whole British aristocracy thing where he's not part of the club.
He's not part of the club. Yeah. And he's pissed about this. He thinks he's a pretty talented dude, which he is, to be fair. And, you know, he's not going to get promoted. He's not making much money. And one day, you know, the Japanese Navy have an office in London. You know, their goal is to get new technology, learn about British airplanes. And, one day he walks right in there and he says, "Hi, nice to meet you. You know, my name's Rutland. I'd like to talk to you." And the Japanese officers there, they know exactly who he is, right? Yeah. You know, they're looking for the newest technology, and this guy walks right into their office.
And he's brilliant, and he knows a lot about the early days, certainly of, you know, when you think about the technically the first guy that ever flew off an aircraft carrier, correct? I mean, of a ship,
yeah.
flew off a ship in World War One, when I didn't even know that that had happened in World War One. So that's how he initially gets involved with the Japanese. They start using him more and more. They're paying him. He gets involved with private companies. His cover is that he's a businessman doing business over in Japan. And that gets me to the lead up to Japan's involvement in World War II. I don't know how to ask this question other than to you, other than saying, why were the Japanese so aggressive during this time? You think of this as, was it the superiority complex that they had in Nazi Germany, where we're the ones that should control Asia because we're the best people? I mean, they were. It was an amazingly aggressive run-up to the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, very aggressive and not too smart, right?
Yeah,
not too smart.
Right. Right.
You know, like you got you're in a war in China, and then you want to attack the U.S., which has got triple the population, 10x the economy. You know,
right.
it wasn't a good idea. It was a lot of machismo and kind of like a cult. Like I've got a lot of buddies in the Japanese naval forces today. They helped me with the research here. They're like, yeah, it was a cult, you know, around the emperor, just like anything. And we were going to be the best, right?
We're the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of gets to that in all conflicts when you think about it, really. Mm-hmm. You can look at Putin in Ukraine now, that, you know, we're the dominant people. We need to, that belongs to us. That's there's a hubris there that is interesting to watch.
The motto back then, Mike, was make Japan great again. Is what they had hats.
They had red hats. They were going to rallies. That's the way. As far as this guy, not only he makes the initial contact. To make it to paraphrase it, he gets assigned to be in Hollywood because, and this is something I didn't know until I read the book. You think of Pearl Harbor as always being where the Pacific Fleet was based. It was not. It was on the West Coast, and they wanted somebody in the L.A. San Diego area that could check out where things. And they knew for a long time this plan was in place for a long time to get as much intelligence about the American Navy as they could.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Frederick Rutlum was the guy that one of the guys that they were using for this, and his cover was a highfalutin businessman, and he loved that. I mean, he loved hobnobbing with the because a lot of the actors were British out in Hollywood at the time. I know that in your book, you do say people ask you all the time whether he was a good guy or a bad guy, and you say obviously he was a bad guy. But ultimately, do you think that he had the potential to be a hero instead of a villain in this story if things might have gone a little differently?
Yeah. I mean, when he first came out and tried to help, you know, so a couple of years before the Pearl Harbor attack, he decided, you know, I'm going to go help the U.S. And you could argue that he was just trying to make a little extra money on the side or
cover his own ass a little bit.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. But,
right.
you know, was he legitimately going to help? I think he was, you know, that the U.S. Navy thought he was. The FBI did not.
Yeah.
But
Over.
Yeah. But, you know, assuming you think he was the real thing, he's like, look, I've been in Japan for, you know, back and forth 20 years. All the heads of the Japanese Navy are my buddies. I've known these guys. We've been drinking. I've been to their houses. They like me. I like them. I know them better than anyone on the planet who's not in the Japanese Navy. And I'm going to help you. I know what they're thinking. I know what they're going to do.
Yeah, and he knew them because he was involved. This took place over many, 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 many years, and when it got right down to it, you know, he had already been taken out of the game, so to speak.
Yeah.
As far as this story is tragic on so many levels, and it's a related question. Do you think it's hard for me to imagine that anything would have prevented the attack? But do you think that because they kept it from their own people by and large, the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor changed the outcome. I just wonder if placement of ships, where they were. I mean, we got lucky that that many of the ships at Pearl Harbor were out to sea at this particular time, but enough were in the harbor to do amazing damage. What do you think, Frederick Rutland? The story is centered around him. What do you think his biggest flaw? He had many, but what do you think was his biggest flaw? You know, this double agent who seemed to come in late to the game to say, "Oh, I'm going to help the United States now," but for years and years had been giving Japan military intelligence.
Yeah, you know, he could have been a lot more discreet about it. It's like a lot of these egomaniacs, right? You get it; it goes to your head. You think you can do no wrong, and you start letting things slip. Right.
Right. Right. I think that the idea of his giving the intelligence to Japan, he always said that he didn't feel that he was doing damage to Britain. His loyalty was to Britain, and he kind of covered in his own mind the fact that he was giving them intelligence about the United States Navy because, well, I'm a Briton, and that doesn't necessarily matter. Do you think that's how he rationalized it in his own mind?
Yeah, there was a couple things going on. One is that, you know, a second thing was like, you know, there's never going to be really a war, right? Like,
yeah. No, that's right. That was kind of the big thing, too. That would never be so insane as to attack the United States.
Right.
Yeah.
Which they went ahead and did. Yeah. we're talking with Ronald Drabkin. The book is Beverly Hills Spy. This is an amazing book. When I finished this book, the first thing I said to myself was, this would be an expensive movie to make, but it would be an amazing movie to see. Any discussions? This makes for Mission Impossible. There's so many different layers to this story of intelligence, and it's Hollywood too. I mean, have you had any discussions with anyone about that?
Yeah, my agent Mike has been talking to some people in Hollywood. But
it would make a great movie. I mean, I'm curious whether that would happen or not.
Yeah, I mean, you're also dead right on that. You know, war movies and period films are expensive to make, right? Yeah. So that's been the discussion.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rob.
I think it would, to tack on to what Mike said, it would be a great movie because of the way you tell the story. And history can be dry. History can be a drag. Anyone who has a bad history professor remembers how it can be. But you lay this out very cinematically. Your storytelling skills are wonderful. And the way you block it off by periods of time in perfect chronological order, there's something in the forward that you had to invent dialogue to make the story sort of go, because there's no actual, you know, transcripts of the dialogue. Was that one of the funner parts to writing the book, when you had to sort of put yourself in those situations and have these people talk and turn them into characters? Because obviously, no one who's alive has met them, so you have to sort of create them from what you've read and researched. Was that fun?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, if once you've read 2,000 pages, 5,000 pages of interviews and transcripts, like all the MI5 transcripts are there, you know, FBI transcripts, you know, you see what they're saying, right? You know what kind of tone they're using, right? And you know, it's like, yeah, God dang it. It's like, you know, history shouldn't be dry.
No, you're right. No,
and most of the history that I enjoy are historical novels when you really tell a story to kind of place us there. But all of this stuff is real. He was an agent for the Japanese Navy in Hollywood. He's surrounded by Charlie Chaplin, Boris Karloff. You can't make it up. It's an amazing, amazing story. And one thing I took away from the book is that military intelligence, the oxymoron that is used so often.
Yes, true.
Things haven't really changed that much, right? It ultimately comes down to human beings betraying other human beings.
Yeah. And when you talk about agencies not cooperating, you know, a lot of the folks I've talked to a lot of the folks who are the agencies today or retired folks in the agencies. And it's a really interesting conversation because they say, look what happened at 9/11. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there were clues here, clues there, clues here. You know, there was the guy who like learned to fly a plane, but he wasn't paying attention at the part about landing.
It happens to this very day. How is your book? I'm sure living in Tokyo, you have Japanese friends. How do they look at the book? How have they enjoyed the book?
Oh, I mean, they're actually, I was a little worried about that, actually.
Yeah, I would be if I was living in Tokyo.
Right. And, mm-hmm. But, you know, they've been kind of, you know, pretty, in a way, flattered. Like, hey, look what we pulled off, you know?
It's true. I mean, it really is.
That's kind of, I would not expect that attitude, you know, some 70, 80 years later. That's very wild. That's
90,
very
really,
telling.
When you talk about Frederick Rutland.
That's true, but right. I was thinking of the actual bombing.
Well, Ronald, I think the book is fantastic. And I think it's, you know, when something can be entertaining and educational at the same time, it's just right to the bitter end. this book is just,
thanks, sir.
I mean, my jaw dropped. I didn't see that. I really didn't see that coming, but it really is something else. Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor. And, you know, in modern history, one of the most cataclysmic events in American history. Ronald, good luck with the book. And thanks so much for coming on.
We'd love
and this
it.
Is this is summertime right here, ladies and gentlemen. Check this one out. And do you get back to the States very often, or are you a permanent resident of Tokyo?
I get back. Yeah, for sure.
Do you speak Japanese?
I do, yeah. Yeah.
Would you like to say goodbye to our listening audience in Japanese? I always like that. I'm an idiot.
Jeez. My dad used to say that all the time.
Disc jockey.
Domo arigato, Mr.
Arigato. Hi.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, Ronald,
so cool.
Good luck with the book, and thanks for coming on. It's
thank
fantastic.
You, gentlemen.
Congratulations on the book, Ronald.
That's Ronald Grabkin, and Beverly Hills Spy is the book, and fun. Did you get through the whole thing yet, Rob?
Did you finish it yet? I did. It's fascinating, and
it's on an upward curve. You start out, and there's a lot of stuff going on, and then it gets
the
groundwork. Rocking.
You lay the groundwork. So, I mean, he is a marvelous storyteller, and that's
really
what history has to be. And by the time the character is hanging with Charlie Chaplin and Thomas Ince and Boris Karloff. And then there's the whole, we didn't even touch on the fact about the houseboy and the blackmail.
There's so much going
on. It's great.
It's incredible. I think get yourself ready to learn Japanese pronunciations of those names. There's Toshida, there's Yokoyama, there's it goes
Benny
on
Hana
and on
is
and
one
on.
Of them.
It's really amazing.
I'm curious though, and I am really taken with his answer about declassified documents. The fact that once everyone is dead, they can start declassifying stuff.
J. Edgar Hoover was someone, and I think there have been many things written about J. Edgar Hoover, not the greatest guy in the world, but ultimately one of the great ass coverers, and in some cases covered them with a dress.
The length of his career.
Yeah, he gathered intelligence on the power brokers and had dirt on everybody, and that's what kept him in power. What also kept him in power was building on a reputation and a PR, the FBI getting the bad guys like John Dillinger and all the – he built on that, and he presented the FBI. He had a certain image that he wanted the Bureau to uphold. They were the guys – I don't know if this makes sense to anybody, but to my friends that have friends in law enforcement,
right.
I will tell you that it is kind of like the by-the-book agencies and then the local cops that can be friends, live in neighborhoods and stuff, and then you get the state guys that, you know, no. The FBI was by-the-book all the way, we're the best, you know, nobody can do better than we can, we're the gold standard, and so you still... To this day, even when they release classified documents, you get so much stuff that's been redacted. And, you know, the Office of Naval Intelligence, those guys were much more aware. There's a guy in the book named Zacharias who ends up being booted out of the Office of Naval Intelligence. They give him a command. They give him a ship.
Right.
But he was the guy that I think if he had stayed in his position in Naval Intelligence and was respected, you'd have... You know, more of a chance of at least knowing what the ultimate plans were going to be. Not only did we not know where the sneak attack was coming from because it was, you know, the element of surprise, we didn't know whether they were even planning on doing it. And it just went on and on.
The troubling thing in the book to me, and I've talked to my grandparents before they passed about like when they found out about Pearl Harbor and how it came to them because, you know, they're across a country. They were in... A part of Virginia that was not very well connected.
Right.
What troubles me is how there were so many signs leading up to it and people in power that knew something was coming. Yeah. And it's just it's boggling. But with the redacted stuff and the declassified documents, a person could go their whole life, have a very adequate understanding of World War II without ever knowing the story that is told in Beverly Hills Spy. And reading this makes so much sense to fit it into the puzzle. I wonder if, as more documents declassify, if we're going to see more and more layers of what went on in World War II that we've never been taught.
And I don't want to confuse people and say that this is the guy that was responsible for the attack. He wasn't.
No, not at all.
What he was responsible for was getting the Japanese technology, specifically aircraft technology, that allowed them to have these long-range planes that could get to Pearl Harbor. And he knew a lot about that. And then when it came to the Pacific Fleet out on the West Coast in California, it was, this is where our ships are, this is who's going where, this is doing that, and ultimately crossed the border into Mexico to directly hand off his intelligence that he had. And they caught a lot of guys, too.
They did.
What you do get is the marriage between politics and the intelligence service, where they're, we don't want to cause an international incident. MI5 knows this guy's doing this, but we really don't want to share it with the Americans because that would embarrass the British government. That kind of BS. And that goes on today. That goes on today.
Well, I love the fact that you pointed out that it does go on today, but now in the ages of text and email, we cannot communicate faster than ever before. And so it's no excuse that this stuff is happening to this day. It's like we can't learn a lesson.
If you love history, like I do, and you
really
want...
If you like
history,
actually.
And if you really want to read a page turner that's got a lot of intrigue in it, it's really, really cool. And at the heart of it is this guy who was not a good guy. It had a real rough moral compass. It wasn't just sleeping with other officers' wives that was involved in that.
There was a month or so when he was a good dad.
But the travel, I mean,
I
we never really got into that. He didn't get into that. But I will tell you that when this guy goes from Hollywood to Japan, to San Francisco, to London, to Wales, then back to Hollywood, then to Japan again, and he does it during the 20s and 30s.
I can't
when
imagine.
It's all done by ship.
Yeah.
Until the very end, where I think he gets a military transport to go back to Britain when they're going to, lock him up. There, I gave something away. Sorry about that. Read the
spoiler
book.
Spoiler alert.
It's all in there. We got to take a break. We're not going to have the round table next. We are going to have a taste test sensation.
Oh, boy.
Because I hold in my hand a Kit Kat bar, and I hold in my hand a bottle of tomato ketchup, and we're going to do something disgusting with it. Well, maybe not. We'll see.
Could be great.
When we come back, you can eat. Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? The man is a force. He is still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. But what's mind-blowing is that he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than the guys half his age. It is all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and down it. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Rob, you're liking it, right?
Yeah, I'm taking it. Robert's taking it. We both love it. And as someone who loves lemonade, it does taste like strawberry lemonade. Every day I take it, my digestion is smoother. I have energy. I feel younger. It's great stuff.
Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/TMOS for up to 44% off your regular priced order. And remember, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/TMOS today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary. So much sun out there, people. Don't you want to protect your ink? Of course you
yes.
do. Listen to me. If you have some killer tats, you need Mad Rabbit. Mad Rabbit is committed to reinventing tattoo aftercare. Mad Rabbit creates simple, effective, and natural products that help improve and preserve tattoos. all delivered directly to your door. It was founded by two friends who love tattoos. Their hero product, the Tattoo Bomb, revitalizes, replenishes, and preserves tattoo ink with clean and natural ingredients, and it's effective on both new and old tattoos and all skin types. Julia uses it. Our man, Josh Soroka, who has I don't think we're giving anything away. He has the Oriole bird tattooed on every part of his body in different
and
locations.
And Brooks Robinson on one particular place of his body.
Where do you have Boog Powell, Josh? Where is that?
Boog Powell. No Boog Powell yet. Hi.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, but Father's Day
you
is
know,
coming.
But I did have to redo my Oriole tattoo because the sun destroyed it. So just a couple months ago, I had it redone.
Yep.
And now I'm using the Mad Rabbit to keep it safe.
Oh, that's great.
Executive producer, business manager, eyes on the prize, two hosts just fooling around and being stupid. Now is the time.
Well, it's also a true story.
It is. Now is the time to try out Mad Rabbit. They preserved over 3 million tattoos, and they've got an exclusive offer just for our listeners. If you go to madrabbit.com/TMOS25 and use promo code TMOS25, you'll receive 25% off. Pay attention. That's a different code. 25% off when you head to madrabbit.com/TMOS25 and use our promo code TMOS25. All right, I don't remember where this came from. This coming from one of your
Flipside
videos?
I can show you the video that we watched just briefly to set the scene.
Okay.
This was a trending issue on TikTok that actually the Kit Kat people jumped on, and they posted this video of Kit Kat employees trying ketchup on a Kit Kat bar.
Good bite for everybody. Look at that. Cheers.
That's a lot on.
Mm-hmm. So those are the employees reacting. They have ketchup, looks like Heinz, going onto the Kit Kat. This is
That's
a lady with
like
glasses.
That's actually really nice.
And she likes it. And I think it went 2 for 3 on
Was
the
there
employees.
A third person that tried it that didn't
Oh yeah,
like
there's
it.
Actually two more. There's this young lady.
Let's see how she likes it.
She takes a bite. She says a no.
No.
And then the gentleman who went overboard on the ketchup. And he likes
okay.
it.
Okay. Three Let me tell up. You what I observe. I'm glad you played this before we did this because the people that seem to be enjoying it seem to be putting more ketchup on it, like a lot of ketchup.
Yeah. Now, where do you stand on ketchup as a rule?
As a condiment?
Yeah.
I'm a fan. I enjoy ketchup on French fries. I've even been known to put ketchup on eggs, but I am not. I don't believe that it is the ultimate. If ketchup went away, it would not be that big a deal. I
it
know
would
there are
break
people
my father's heart. We
he
have,
loves ketchup.
Oh, God, we're a ketchup family. And, you know, when he would go down to his beach house, there was one grocery store he would always stop at on the way from the D.C. area to the Eastern Shore. And just in case, he would always buy ketchup. So I would go down and open the pantry at the beach house, and there'd be like 10 bottles of ketchup. Just in case. So,
Josh, let me ask you this. Do you have a Kit Kat bar up in Maryland?
I do. I got a Kit Kat bar. I've got some ketchup.
Why don't we start with
packets.
You? Why don't we start with you, Josh? Can
and
you,
also,
can you,
Mike, I did want to tell you, I'm going to take it to the next level because I've brought three other condiments to try.
On the Kit Kat?
On the Kit Kat bar.
Well, way to go.
I'm excited for the... Right. Some mayonnaise, relish. What other condiments do you have there?
No, I have... An often overlooked condiment and one of my favorites, Heinz 57 sauce.
All right, I get that.
Which is sort of a variant on ketchup.
Okay.
French's simple yellow mustard.
I think that's going to be nasty.
And by the way, I have to shake it. You don't want the goo at the top. And then the one I'm most excited about, Mike. Cholula hot sauce.
Wow. All right, so
those are all strong flavors.
Yes, they
are. Josh, I'd like you to be the sacrificial lamb. And go. And is there a way you can expand? I'll expand, Josh. Sure.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
Okay. I can do this.
There you go. There we want to see it.
Okay, he's opening his Kit Kat.
So,
as you know, Mike, there are four
Kit Kat
sticks.
Ketchup.
Well, there's eight in mine because it's the king size.
Oh,
the
king
size.
All right.
That's just what they had in 7-Eleven.
All right.
And, Mike, as you know, the king size Kit Kat bar, $17.50. That's all you have to pay.
I love Kit Kat, by the way. one of my favorite candy bars.
And I don't use much ketchup on things.
Okay. What's your favorite condiment, would you say?
So and by the way, I like ketchup.
Do you get that at Camden Yards, that ketchup? Did you bring
the
that?
The ketchup packet?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if my sister had ketchup. I assumed she did, but I saw
that,
a whole...
Is that a Camden Yards?
I saw a whole bucket.
Ketchup packet. That's awesome. I like
it. It is, but I mean, it's just a Heinz. There's nothing...
I know. I get
there's no baseball on it.
It's Jim Palmer ketchup, Mike.
All right, so I ran some ketchup across, like the video, where they're doing the whole four. So let's see.
Right. Here we go.
Healthy bite.
I would imagine you have to let it, you know... Mix
savor and marinate.
Savor a little bit. I'm not seeing a grocery. Yeah,
not for me. The ketchup. The ketchup is really strong.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. Well, it's Heinz. I'm going to use that. All right. I'm going to go.
Mike, what's the brand of ketchup that you served at O'Mara's?
House recipe, Rob. Thanks. That's why we failed. That's why we failed.
I was really hoping
we
you'd
switched
have a
to Heinz and we went broke.
I was really hoping you'd have some house recipe.
House
for
recipe
us this
ketchup.
Morning.
Or Hunt's.
Hunt's, right, Mike. It's fancy ketchup.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Put the ketchup on it. I'm going to put it on liberally.
I think that was my mistake. Is I'm not a huge ketchup guy, and I put a lot of ketchup on there.
I see. I see.
So the ketchup definitely overwhelms the ketchup or the chocolate.
Yeah.
Is that enough?
And I'm kind of...
That's plenty.
Yeah, that's great.
All right, here we go.
It'll complement your wafer. Nice big bite from Mike. Chewing. No?
No.
All right.
No. It's the flavors do not mix.
No.
Maybe your problem is
I will take another bite. It doesn't make it inedible.
I think your problem, Mike, is your application process. So what I've done is I've plated my Kit Kat. Okay.
Somebody's gone the whole way. Way to go, Rob Spiewak.
And then I'm going to put the ketchup.
Okay, I'm
going to
go. Can I modify my review?
Yeah.
It's flipping nasty.
Oh, is it that bad?
It's disgusting.
For some reason, the second bite tastes worse.
Yes. I'm with
you.
I don't know why. It makes no sense.
1,000%.
All right, so I'm going to actually use a French fry technique, Mike. I'm going to dip a single Kit Kat into the ketchup.
All right.
Uh-huh. Come see. And then?
I'm cleaning my palate with just regular Kit Kat.
No.
Ah! Who are the people that liked it? What kind of... It destroys flavor.
Aren't they COVID people that don't have any sense of taste? Oh, it burns in the back, too.
Yeah, it gets worse.
Maybe what it needs, Mike, is simple yellow mustard.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is like the kids eating Tide Pods where it's fake, where people are just doing this for the internet, just for attention?
I don't know, because the Kit Kat Instagram and TikTok jumped on board.
It appears to be legit.
Mike, look at that lovely palette of yellow and brown.
All right, so the review on the ketchup, Rob, would be?
Unedible. Inedible.
Inedible.
Right. Okay, Josh is going for water now.
This
is Kit Kat and mustard, Mike.
I will not have another bar.
Kit Kat and mustard, also nothing I would ever do, but believe it or not, better than ketchup.
Compared to the ketchup?
Better than that, yeah.
Really?
Well, I think the hot sauce intrigues me when you get to that.
That's why I'm saving it for last.
Because that'll add a little punch and not overwhelming. The ketchup was overwhelming.
Heinz 57 sauce, Mike, as you know, adds zest to chicken, steak, and pork.
Now, that has a Worcestershire component to it, does it not?
It
does. So Rob's going to try that right now.
Also, I do think this is a dippable thing if you're going to do it. Don't slather it on the bar. I like the fact that...
So you put it on
a
delicate amount.
Yeah, I like to dip. I put my hand upon my hip.
By the way, only 210 calories for this whole candy bar, which I think, you know, comparatively not all that bad.
You could eat five.
Is that a whole second? Is that a second pack?
This is a second Kit Kat bar.
I bought two as well.
We went out and we got two last night. Two.
All right.
Two.
Right.
Two.
Hoping it was good.
Heinz 57. Better than the mustard.
I hate hearing his lips smack. It grosses me out.
And worse than the ketchup.
Worse than the ketchup.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Mike, this is a Cholula hot sauce, Chipotle flavor. Ask for it by name. It's the hot sauce with the wooden top.
Do you use hot sauce in the Spiewak household on a regular basis?
Pretty much. Robert is a fiend for it. He loves Texas Pete. We have a big bottle of Texas Pete upstairs.
They call him Texas Pete. He's the king of the Texas Pete.
All right. You really can't dip in hot sauce, so here's the application. Here we go. Yeah, we keep Tabasco, Cholula, Texas Pete, and another one. Frank's Red Hot. Here we go. Wait a second.
Delayed effect.
Give it a moment. Got to marinate.
Ooh, could we have another result?
That's the best of the four.
Because it's probably the least invasive.
Yeah.
It's just heat, yes. Right?
And a little smoke because it's Chipotle. Right, also hot sauce on it.
How many
ketchup? Yeah, I'd rather have my mouth burning now than ketchup.
I ate three, the equivalent of, Mike, here is my plate. Oh, it almost looks like a happy face. Look. Ta-da!
I'm going to tell you this, that when you do this experiment,
yeah,
get ready to realize how nasty ketchup is when you do
this. No, it's not nasty.
Because a sweet, lovely Kit Kat bar is such a perfect candy bar. And then when you put this stuff on it.
Well, Mike, it's really not the fault of the ketchup. It's the fault of the internet. Internet. Because
tomato concentrate from red ripe tomatoes, distilled vinegar, high fructose corn syrup.
Ah, you see, Mike, that's where you're wrong because you need to buy Simply Ketchup from Heinz with no artificial ingredients.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Is it more expensive?
This bottle costs $60.
There you go. It's delicious.
So, yeah, but you know what? Even though the hot sauce was best, I still wouldn't cross the road for it. It's a candy bar. It doesn't need accoutrement. It's
no, but just, I mean, it was just an experiment to see. Yeah. And really, with the advent of sweet and savory, which seems to be part of so many foods. It's by the way, something I don't adhere to. When you're talking about like a leg of lamb and
my father
could not eat a leg of lamb without mint jelly, and then
the
mint jelly. It grossed me out. I want jelly. The only thing I might like a duck breast with a sauce of like an orange sauce,
Mike,
or a cherry sauce.
What about turkey and cranberry, though?
It's no,
pretty good.
I don't mind cranberry as a side
when you have a little cranberry,
but I don't eat it with the turkey.
When you make your post-Thanksgiving Day sandwich.
Nope.
The big Dagwood turkey sandwich. You don't put cranberry sauce on it?
No.
Cranberry sauce and mayonnaise together on a layer is perfect.
No.
My cranberry sauce goes more with the mashed potatoes far as the Thanksgiving meal.
That's weird.
My cranberry sauce is standalone. And by the way, I make it from scratch every Thanksgiving. And thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, I know it's easy.
Big cranberry salutes you, Mike. Show them your ocean spray medal.
F you and your families, too. I have to say this. That my cranberry sauce involves...
Brings all the boys to your yard?
Three fruits.
Really? I only use two.
The orange.
Yes.
The cranberry.
Yes.
And the apple. I dice up a Honeycrisp apple into my cranberry sauce.
Do you peel it? So it sort of dissolves. You peel the apple, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, I mean, I chop it up. I don't know if I peel it all.
So, so then it sort of dissolves in there.
Oh,
natural
God.
Sweetness. Do you use any sugar?
No, I don't use any sugar. I want to move on. Thank you. We've got the round table coming.
We do.
Up,
and so. Mike, just later on tonight, before you make your weekly batch of cranberry sauce,
yes.
I will meet you in the bog.
The bog, the cranberry bog.
You still
realize,
have it in your backyard, right?
Well, we don't look the same, but Rob and I were the two principals in the Bartles and James commercials. We will take a break, and when we come back, we've got a lot of news.
10.
A lot of interesting news, including about the penis. When we come back on the Mike O'Meara Show. Now I have to minimize that. There we go. And I have to go over here, and I have to talk about this.
Yes.
This fantastic product. And by the way, look what my lovely wife did for me today.
What'd she do?
She brought all my liquid IV sticks in.
Are there any white peach in there, or is she still hoarding it?
I don't know where. Don't get me started on this. She's hidden the white peach.
I know
she has.
I know all
and
about
I've got,
it.
By the way, I love my lemon lime. Don't get me wrong, but I love white peach too, and I want to, you know, want to shake things up. But there's your liquid IV stick. I've already put it in, mixed it into my red cup, my Pizza Hut cup.
Yeah.
So this stuff is fantastic, and I will tell you when we're on the surface of the sun, which we are now, here in Florida. Well, you might say the surface of the ocean because we're flooding out. Like you wouldn't believe down here. I'll talk about that.
Great for bogs.
Rehydration is key. Hot weather requires extraordinary hydration. You've got to be aware of it. Liquid IV hydrates you with benefits like electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients. When I went to the hospital after my car accident on Saturday, I had not had my fix of liquid IV because I haven't been playing a lot of golf. So the guy said I was dehydrated.
It's probably why you wrecked your car, Mike.
It's probably the reason I got my accident. Three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink in a single stick. It's clear why liquid IV is the number one powdered hydration brand in America. The secret is LIV, live. Not the golf tour.
No.
Live Hydroscience, or LIV Hydroscience, the science-backed formula that's an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients to turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. It's fantastic. You'll love it. We love it. Terra 4, live more. One stick, 16 ounces of water. Hydrates better than water alone. Turn your ordinary water into extraordinary hydration with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code TMOS at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code TMOS at liquidiv.com. And now I'm pointing at you.
News.
News. News, ladies and gentlemen.
We start today, ladies and gentlemen, with a guy that's been on this show. Actually, we'll start. I'd rather start with a legendary basketball player. Basketball Hall of Famer, Jerry West, died yesterday. He was 86 years old. West is actually a soon-to-be three-time Hall of Famer. He went in as a player in 1980, as a member of the gold medal-winning 1960 Olympic team in 2010. And in August, he'll go in again as a contributor to the sport. Portrayed very badly in the Lakers docudrama that they put out there.
You know, the Showtime Lakers one that was on. Yeah, I loved that miniseries, though. It was good.
He played 14 seasons in the NBA, all-star in all of them. He also won a championship with the 1972 Lakers. He retired in 74, was the general manager of 8 Lakers championship teams. In addition to his legendary career, he's also the guy on the NBA logo.
Yes.
Which most people know that follow the sport. At least that's the legend. In 2021,
yeah, they haven't ever confirmed it, but I've seen a picture of him that is exactly that silhouette.
Well,
so
if they confirmed it, they'd probably have to pay.
That's true.
Yeah, that's the way it works. In 2021, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said, quote,
"While it's never been officially declared that the logo is Jerry West, it sure looks a lot like him."
Oh, Adam. Oh, Adam. And also,
Adam Silver.
Robert asked me to mention that he was and is honored in their facility there, a WVU grad. He's one of the greatest players to ever come out of WVU.
He was a man there.
That's right. That's right.
Safe travels to Jerry West, ladies and gentlemen. Guy we've had on the show, Joey Chestnut. He has been banned from the annual Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest this year, but there is a silver lining to that. He is now free to face off against his longtime rival, Takuru Kobayashi. Again, Kobayashi is the other famous
You know,
eater.
Mike, we mentioned yesterday him being excluded from Nathan's.
Yes.
And now it becomes so clear why he was excluded from Nathan's. Because he's got his own thing he's doing now. And there's more money in that for him.
Well,
we're
but
being
it's not
played
a conspiracy.
By...
You make it sound like it might be a conspiracy.
It
with
is.
It's
absolutely not a conspiracy. Not for Nathan's. It's Joey's. It's Joey's conspiracy. He, a good guy, is playing you, America. Be aware.
But no, I think it's just
agree.
The timing of the news. He signed the impossible deal because it was a lot of money. And then once he found out Nathan's wouldn't have him, he knew he had to do something. We talked yesterday about how Impossible needs to sponsor something. for him.
Yeah,
so
and that's
he's got one.
All this was in. I guarantee you all this have been in motion since
Christmas.
Everything
is a conspiracy. No. I mean, are you QAnon? Is that what you
no,
are?
No, no, no.
What's going on with this?
Here are the conspiracies that are currently going on. Right. The Joey Chestnut conspiracy. Why did CBS cancel 60 Minutes? And putting ketchup on a Kit Kat. Those, if you go to conspiracy.org, those are the top three conspiracies.
Okay. If this was really a long-term setup, he would be doing it on the 4th of July, not September 2nd.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's conspiracy, Rob.
I never said it was a smart conspiracy. I just said it was a conspiracy.
Shut up! Okay. It's happening on Labor Day. It'll air on Netflix. Chestnut versus Kobayashi. Unfinished beef.
Chestnut.
The last time they competed against each other was in 09, and Chestnut won. He ate 68 hot dogs in 10 minutes.
10?
68 dogs. Huh?
You know what he should do for competitive eating? He should eat chestnuts.
Shut up!
68 dogs in 10 minutes. Kobayashi ate 64 and a half.
That's right.
Which is a lot of dogs, you know?
Yeah, and Kobayashi is also living in Hollywood right now.
Right. And without ketchup.
He's flying on the Pacific Fleet.
He is.
Kobayashi cut ties with Nathan's in 2010 because he refused to sign an exclusive contract. Chestnut says, quote, "Through all of my years in competitive eating, Kobayashi stands out as my fiercest rival. Competing against him pushed me to be so much better. It's time to give the people what they want." I hate eating contests.
I do too. Carrie loves them. I just hope he doesn't have to return the mustard belt.
Thank you. Anyway, we move on now with Andrew McCarthy, who has a documentary about the Brat Pack in the 80s, and it hit Hulu today. It's called Brats. And here are some highlights. Andrew wore a wig in the final scene of Pretty in Pink. The ending had to be reshot to show him getting with Molly Ringwald, but he already cut his hair for the next role. Number two, Demi Moore had a sober coach on the set of St. Elmo's Fire. She's just a kid. She has a sober coach. Molly didn't participate in the documentary because she'd rather keep looking forward. Emilio Estevez refused to do more movies with anyone from the Brat Pack after The Breakfast Club because he didn't want to be typecast. Well, perhaps he should have.
Yeah, all right. Grab that money while you can.
You know that he had the Mighty Ducks. So that was cool. Let's see. The instrumental love song in St. Elmo's Fire hit number 15 on the Billboard Hot 100.
Yes.
And Andrew had a crush on Ally Sheedy. And the only thing I remember about The Breakfast Club when Ally Sheedy was when she scrapes the dandruff off of her hair.
To make it look like snow. It's disgusting. It's
very, very disgusting.
Mike, did you know the wig that he wore is the same wig that John Travolta wore in Hairspray?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I don't know what that means, but it does.
Google it, folks. It's funny.
Okay. It just makes me want to say one thing, ladies and
gentlemen. Shut up!
Come on now.
Want to revisit the Saw franchise? I know you're a big fan, Rob.
Love it. The kids love it.
You know what you should? Well, that's good. It's funny you mentioned the kids because you should subscribe to get all the Saw movies to Disney Plus.
You're kidding.
You can stream the first 7 Saw movies there thanks to the new Disney Plus Hulu bundle. Obviously, that's pretty messed up. But as one person put it on social media, quote, "Late-stage capitalism doesn't get enough credit for occasionally being pretty funny." Disney brings you the Saw franchise. And you know, it probably should be us. Somebody should do a mashup. Should do a mashup with it's Disney, the most magical place on earth. And you see people getting their
gosh,
you know. That's Goofy.
Yes.
Caught in a saw trap.
Gosh. I can't feel my legs.
Starting next month, new cars in Europe will be required to come with tech that alerts you if you're speeding. You'll be able to turn the feature off, though. Some people want it added to new cars here. So an insurance group did a new poll, and it is a surprisingly popular idea. I would go for it in a minute.
You have that feature in your car. It's called Carla.
I have the feature. My car's in a scrapyard right now. 60% of Americans think it'd be okay if a feature like that came on at the beginning of every trip to make the road safer. Here's another idea. What if as you sped up, your gas pedal got harder and harder to push down? 51% think that would be okay, too.
No.
The least popular option was doing a limiter to prevent your engine from letting you speed at all. But still, 48% of Americans think that's a decent idea. When you go through a major car accident, ladies and gentlemen, you become exclusively aware of just how bad people drive and how dangerous people drive. And I'm in that stage right now.
I know
now,
that, Mike, you have not been speeding since Saturday, and I approve of that. I know that your current car that you have up until Saturday couldn't speed even if you pushed it down a hill.
This is true.
Well, my phone already does that when I'm with the phone plugged into the car. When I put in like the maps or whatever, it says the speed limit, and it gets bigger if I'm speeding or turns red or something like that.
You know what? All I heard was one word.
I know.
You know what that word was?
Yeah,
speeding.
Yeah.
Speeding.
I love it. I'm so glad to be back. I miss that. Isn't that weird?
It is great.
I could do a whole show on that because I am now doing what he does. I don't know what it is. I think it's because I like the guy a lot, and you know, he's been great for the show. So, but for some reason, Carlos said, "You did it again." I said, "What? You dropped a consonant?" I'm like, "Hey."
Well, if you come in tomorrow with your hair spiked up to a point, then we're going to talk.
I don't have enough to do that. Finally today, a tech superstar who has made headlines for his mission to achieve optimal health and reverse the aging process now claims that he has regained the penis function of a teenager. That's right, his Schwanstucker. Tech mogul Brian Johnson, a 46-year-old biohacker obsessed with anti-aging, has claimed to reverse aging in his thing by 15 years through a painful shockwave therapy. Johnson, who spends $2 million annually on various anti-aging treatments, discussed his unconventional approach on the Diary of a CEO podcast.
I'm
the
over shockwave, here now.
There he is. The shockwave therapy involves using a wand that administers acoustic technology. Is that like RF that I got in my brain?
No, it would be just noise. Not like actual RF.
Well, it creates micro injuries similar to workouts, prompting muscle rebuilding. Oh. Despite describing the treatment as 7 out of 10 on the pain scale, with the tip being a 9 out of 10, he expressed satisfaction with the results, stating his subjective experience was that if his penis had become 15 years younger after 2 months, then it would be worth it. There was no information on how he plans to pursue his next project, achieving a high-functioning teenage colon.
There it is. There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
His lovely feathered colon. Ooh.
speaking of, RF free, I had a medical procedure yesterday.
Yes, you did.
Ask all the questions you want on it when we come back. You are listening to the Mike O'Mara Show. And, hey, guess what, everybody?
What?
We're going to be right back. Look at him. Thanks to Dermglow Skin, I've lost over 80 pounds.
You have.
Be careful. And I will continue to lose if I don't eat one of these, a second one on the show you can eat. Don't want to do that. I've never felt better. Now it's cheaper and easier than ever. We're talking lower prices, faster shipping. Hey, guess what? New client coming on board. Jerky! Officer Jerky! Yay!
That's
talking
great!
Yesterday. DermGlowSkin.com offers medical weight loss with semaglutide, or tirzepatide. It's delivered straight to your door. It's the real deal, Wade. And no insurance is needed. Get excited and feel like yourself again. Lose 15 to 26% of your weight from the comfort of your couch. Just go to DermGlowSkin.com, click the weight loss button, take the quiz, and qualify. Real results, real fast, lower prices than ever. Stop the food noise, reclaim your true self, and now ask about raising your testosterone and balancing your hormones. Reach out to Carla for any inquiries. She's dedicated to assisting you. DermGlowSkin.com with the lowest prices ever. Let's go! Yesterday.
Yeah, Jerky's going to look good when he loses weight with that Don Henley haircut. He's going to look good. Hi, Jerky.
And he only has like 30 pounds to lose, but he's big.
But not
he
much.
Wants to get smaller. I have to say that as I sit here right now, I will tell you that my medical procedure was known as an RF ablation, where they, with radio frequency, they go in and they deaden nerves around the back, the discs. What were you saying? What?
I said, hey, man, it's radio ablation, man. Don't play shut up. Don't demean me. Don't do it.
Shut up!
Mike, I ask so little.
You are a blabbermouth.
I'll take it from the great one.
Working it today. So yesterday, because it was at the surgical center, I was a little more nervous than I had to be. I've gotten it at that office before, but they have a big, you know, full-fledged surgical suite upstairs. And the procedure and my respect between a trip to the ER this week and getting that done, my respect for medical people, the nurses, the doctors, the people that help you when you're having a procedure knows no bounds. And I'm here to say where I got this procedure done, so clean, so professional, so well done, so efficient, and you know that they know their stuff. So I'm extremely confident that this is going to last me a good long time, and I'm hopeful that my back issues will go away.
I like However, the fact that it's – I was going to ask a question if I can.
Okay, go ahead. Yep.
We're going through this, you know, the whole process, and you say the place was clean, you were treated well.
It was a really, really nice
What time did you show up, and how long did you have to wait to be taken to the procedure room?
8:15. Yesterday was my arrival time. Mm-hmm. I have to say that driving around here now is problematic because of the rain we've gotten. There are floods everywhere in my area down here. It really makes sense that, you know, when you look at those charts of 50 years down the road where the tip of Florida is underwater, you can see why. And it's not because of the sea level rise as much as it's the rain that just goes on and on. One area got, I think, 4.5 inches of rain in an hour, some ridiculous amount like that. It's crazy time. So
when
we got
I look
down
at those
there,
charts about 50 years in the future, I look to see that the graveyards are still there, so I know that I'll be okay.
Yeah, well, the graves will float when the
well, it depends on your. It definitely happens in certain areas, so watch out for corpses.
I will say this: that during the show on Wednesday, remember when I got that phone call that shut like the show down for a second?
Yeah,
because I saw it was the surgery center.
Yeah,
and they call me. And I got the date for the last time I went in and paid out of pocket because I was not insured at that time. I was insured for the procedure.
OOP, Mike.
Out of pocket,
yes.
And informed me that I was responsible for the payment of $2,000 in the middle of the show. If you will notice, and you go back, if you want to look at that show or listen to that show, you'll notice that after that phone call, I do my level best to focus. I was a mess. I was
do you
a
remember,
hot
Mike,
mess.
Do you remember the news footage of President George W. Bush reading a book to children, and then a Secret Service guy comes in and whispers into his ear about the 9/11 attacks?
His eyes are going back and forth.
That's how you looked.
I was. It sucked. So I get on the phone. I don't remember the lady's name. But
was it Merle?
No. But here's the tell.
Yeah.
On their recording, they say abusive treatment or abusive language, abusive treatment of our employees will not be tolerated. Now, for my money, when you have to put that on a recording,
yes,
and I'm not going to absolve the Karens and the Kevins that might be a-holes to the people there, but you're dealing with a pain clinic.
Yeah.
You're dealing with people who are in pain. And obviously, if they put that on their recording, they have many, 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 many altercations with people.
Sure.
And I don't think they need to. I get on the phone with this lady, and when the great government of Social Security and Medicare and all that stuff took care of me, it was determined that my Social Security date of birth was the 21st, not the 22nd. I've celebrated on the 22nd. I have it on my driver's license, yada, yada. But technically, according to the United States government and according to my insurance now and according to this doctor's office now,
right,
it's the 21st. And so when I go in there and I'll have to probably do some finagling to get everything zeroed in. But, you know, you'd have to ask my mom, and she's dead. So that's unfortunately not going to happen. But
what if you wrote them a note and it says signed Mike O'Mara's mother?
Let me explain. Here's how the conversation went.
Okay.
Hi. I'm just calling because I have insurance now, and I waited to do this procedure for the 12th of June when I was insured. Well, let me look. What's your date of birth? Well, they ask that when you go in. And yeah, I think I said the 22nd. She says, let me go downstairs and talk to the person. She comes back up. She goes, well, your birth date does not match the insurance. I said, I said that to them when I gave them my insurance card on May 7th for a June 12th procedure. I didn't say it like that at this time.
She says,
well, it doesn't. And this is the answer I get. Well, they don't match. Silence.
Okay.
I said, I know that the driver's license doesn't match, but I am covered. And my Medicare is, the same as my Social Security.
Is this the first time you've had some sort of discrepancy between your
date of birth? Yes, because I have new insurance card and Medicare. Ah,
okay, so it could have just been a missed keystroke somewhere.
No. It was. They had it as June 22nd, and they had my driver's license on file.
Okay.
And then I said, okay, why wasn't I told this before? And she says, and this was the answer to that. Because your driver's license said June 22nd. I said, no, you said that when was the claim submitted? Weeks ago. I said, okay, what does that have to do with? So they refused it. Yes. I am going back and forth with her. It's getting more and more argumentative. It's going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to the point where I said, are you arguing with me to argue? I said, I am simply asking a question as to when this problem occurred, why I wasn't notified of it until 24 hours before my procedure, which, by the way, is tomorrow morning. So it goes back and forth and back and forth. And then she hangs up on me and she says, I will go. I will let you know how this is resolved. We've resubmitted it to the insurance company.
Did she say goodbye and then hang up? It was just she finished her sentence and clicked.
She didn't. And then I called back because I needed to talk to somebody. I needed to vent. And I spoke to a very understanding lady who said, I get it. You shouldn't be addressed like that. They shouldn't be arguing. Well, you're in pain. What if I was in real pain? And I wasn't.
Right.
And then she says, listen, I'll follow up on this and I'll let you know. So the entire day goes by on Wednesday and nothing. Nothing from the other lady, nothing from – and I ended up getting from my new insurance company a voicemail that said it's been approved.
Hey, that's
so the
great.
Insurance – and that's something I never had from the other insurance company, so I'm real happy about that. And I'm like, okay. And then I showed up. So I'm here to say the doctor there and the nurses and everybody, phenomenal. Front of the house, it's beyond horrible to deal with people like that.
Yeah, it
you
is.
You suck. And I didn't like it, and I'm not happy. But my feeling was go in, deal with this either before or after the procedure. Didn't care to. Procedure's over. Ever forward. Move forward with that. But it's just, sometimes it just pisses you off. The way people... And I know there's a discrepancy. I understand that. I'm not sure exactly how to pursue that right now because I have a passport. And I have a driver's license, two government-issued IDs that I have to fix.
What's on your birth certificate?
That's a great question. My birth certificate was destroyed in a fire.
Oh, no.
No, it's not. It's
the government always has a copy.
It's a little yellow piece of paper, and that one I have to check. When the show's over today, I will let you know. But I don't want to go to the Social Security Administration and to Medicare and deal with that. I would much rather... but we'll see. Obviously, it's something I have to address.
Was it really that hard back in the day when you were born to know what day of the week it was?
You'd have to ask my dear departed mother, Josh.
Were they using the Julian calendar then?
Right.
Back in the day, we just discovered the wheel and fire. There was a lot going on.
Mom was busy.
Your dad was
hunting. He was gathering.
Hunting and gathering.
Or a really long delivery. It started on the 21st, finished on the 22nd.
This is the truth. I was told that the procedure, my birth, happened around midnight on the 21st.
I heard that after midnight, you were going to shake your tambourine.
With Eric Clapton?
Yes.
After midnight. All right, that's enough. That's
well, look at you. You're feeling better already.
If you don't hit the thingy, I'm gonna play it.
No, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it because we have the flip side coming up. And a promo, Mike. There's a promo in this break.
Oh, there is. Okay, yes. We'll be back with Rob Spiewak's flip side right here on the Mike O'Mara Show. Whoa. Oh, I found it.
Don't play it.
Shut up!
Damn it.
Oh, no. Where will you go and what will you do to make your car run like new again?
A motto repair.
We can take an incredibly totaled car and make it brand new again.
Folks, don't settle for imitators. When you want authentic TMOS merchandise, there's only one place to look. TMOSstore.com. High quality merch with excellent customer service. Your purchases help support TMOS.
Thank you.
And they are grateful for it.
Most of all, helping to feed my family and afford me new cars that I can wreck.
Beep, 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 yeah! TMO!
Thank you. What happened there?
It got cut off for some reason.
Was that from you or from Jim Amato?
That was from Jim Amato, but I will have to reload it in the machine. It cut off the S of TMOS.
Introducing the Mike O'Mara Show playing cards. Do you gamble? Do you like to play poker? Is blackjack part of your daily routine? The amazing Mike O'Mara Show limited edition cards with the faces of Mike and Rob on every card and a gorgeous custom box. The Don't Get Happy Society special cards are the brainchild of the family Spiewak. They will fascinate you. These are premium quality casino grade Rob Spiewak approved decks. Each deck includes two jokers. These make an ideal gift for listeners of the Mike O'Mara Show, card game enthusiasts, or anyone who loves unique collectibles.
Hey, Brian Butterfield.
Yes.
I've been working on this. Name a card. Any card in a standard deck. Go ahead.
10 of Hearts.
It has one of those.
Strictly a limited edition. Buy one for yourself and a few for your friends. Supplies are extremely limited. So, act fast. You haven't done that so far. Analyze Mike's old man signature. It will also fascinate you. Order now and make every game night a hit with Mike and Rob by your side.
Hello.
God help me, Mike. I love cheese. Oh, and here's your 10 of diamonds that you mentioned. Right. Ta-da.
There it is. There's 10 of diamonds in the deck.
It's got one of them.
Everyone.
Cheese is great on almost anything. I'm not sure I'd put cheese on a Kit Kat bar, but I do like cheese on chili. But who wants to go through the hassle of sprinkling cheese on chili?
Oh, gross.
So what you need to get is, you know those party toys? They're party favors, actually, that when you blow them, they unroll?
Whee!
Yeah. Whee. Use those for cheese distribution. You just put cheese on it.
People. That's when I love the internet right there. Look at how many. They're like three shreds.
I know.
Of cheese. I have
to
see that.
It's very directional. It is so. They put the cheese in the unrolled party favor.
I get
let it.
It
roll
and
up.
You don't
and
have
when
to
they
explain
blow,
it, we no, all
there are
saw
people
it.
Who
There's
are listening.
No need to
there are
give
people
the,
that
the,
are listening. That's
all right.
That would have been a lot more fun than ketchup.
Yeah. Yes.
I love the limited amount of cheese. Look at the Miller Lights on the top.
I was going to say, Mike,
like
they're
the
enjoying,
cans.
That, they're enjoying cans. That new built beer from Miller.
They're totally baked doing this. I love
especially
the
that second shot's got like 8 cans laying on its side.
No, let's see, hold on. One more time.
Here we go. One Miller Light.
There we go.
Three oh, Miller
and there's some Modelo, too.
Modelo. Ah, fantastic.
You know that they drank the Miller Lite after Modelo ran out.
I love
King's Dominion. This is no secret to anybody. They are owned by Cedar Fair Amusements. In Sandusky, Ohio, there is another Cedar Fair park. I believe it is called...
Cedar Fair?
Cedar Fair is the company. And I believe it is Cedar Point is the name of this amusement park. And it was a beautiful day at the park yesterday in Sandusky until the giraffes got out.
Oh, no.
Now, I'm sorry, the camels, not giraffes.
Meaner animal.
Yes, they spit. But have you ever seen a camel run? I had never seen.
Oh, I have in Lawrence of Arabia.
Well, that's true. Good point.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is.
That dude almost died.
Oh, and a guy in like a rascal.
Yeah. And they're just running around the park.
Wow.
There he goes.
What a nice little gate, right?
Yeah. But here's the thing. People were so scared, they jumped into the pen that they escaped from. So you know, the camels were running around.
I would not be afraid.
I wouldn't run.
Yeah, no, I think that would make them nervous.
I'd probably walk up and pet it. I don't think it's like a moose that's going to like stomp
spit
you.
But they'll spit on you.
They'll spit on you, and it's kind of gross. The way.
Yeah, and I don't even want to mention the fact that it happened on a Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Hump
what
day.
Does that mean?
Hump day.
Oh.
Hi. Hello. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Cedar Fair Amusements. It's hump day. It's hump day right now. Hi. Hi, Elaine. I'm walking through the park where I'm not supposed to be. It's hump day. Yeah.
Mike, this is funny on its own, but it's also funny. Do you remember a couple of years ago, I guess, there was a man on the street interview in Great Britain, and one of the guys that they talked to randomly turned out to be Henry Winkler. Now, apparently the Fonz is not a very big deal in England.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was simply a man on the street. Well, an historic hotel in Ireland caught on fire yesterday, and everyone was evacuated, and the news crew went to talk to people who evacuated.
No.
And who did they choose?
Again?
Randomly, without giving him any credit, Arthur Fonzarelli, Henry Winkler.
I heard the fire alarm. I thought it was the clock radio. I thought somebody had set the alarm before we got there, you know, like another guest. And finally, I went into another room and it was still buzzing. So I called downstairs and the woman said in a very calm voice, yes, we're all evacuating. You must evacuate right now.
So Henry likes the UK. He likes the
British.
Well,
he's promoting a book right now. He's promoting a book over there.
Okay.
I love Henry Winkler. The fact that
he doesn't have to go there. He can be like our friend, Ronald Drabkin with Beverly Hills Spy, who was in Tokyo. It's the magic of
the internet. She said, maybe. Evacuate now. Evacuate now. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was an alarm.
Why do you sound so different than when you were Fonzie?
Hey!
I don't know. It's a character. It's a character.
I remember the first. You remember the first time? We all do. Remember the first time you heard the real Fonzie's voice?
Uh-huh.
When you heard Henry Winkler? I mean, it's like, yo, hey, I'm Fonzie. And then it's just like,
well, I love the jacket. I couldn't ride the motorcycle. It's horrible.
It's horrible. I'm over here now.
I'm over here now.
But nice. I love Henry Winkler. Still have my Fonz poster. I just wish he got a little more international recognition. Mike, those people who live in Pittsburgh, Jim Amato
included.
Is
it those of people or those people?
Let me check the paper. Hold on.
Is it of those people?
Wait. People of Pittsburgh is what it says. People of Pittsburgh are having a dry summer, and Jim Amato among them. Do you know that it is now June 13th, and they still haven't turned on any of the water fountains in the town of Pittsburgh?
Because of a drought?
No, because they only have one plumber.
This water fountain at the Schenley Oval hasn't...
By the way, I know I say it all the time, but this guy.
This guy.
It's Andy Sheehan, Mike.
And it's not alone. The city has more than 200 water fountains, and we haven't found a single one that's working. We asked the Ganey administration why that is.
Yeah.
Playgrounds, in the parks, and at the trailheads. With the official start of summer just days away, the water fountains still haven't been turned on.
It's Herb.
That is.
Not That's Herb Welsh.
They will be
it
this
is.
Summer. Retired teacher Vivian Kowalski, who strolls Grandview Park every day, thinks it's high time they were.
It's hot. It's like up to 90 degrees, and everybody's sweating. It needs to be rehydrated.
Yeah.
Normally, the fountains get turned on in late April and early May, but in checking throughout the city, we haven't found a single one working.
Mike, they only have, the town of Pittsburgh has one plumber, and they have told him to actually prioritize pools, snack bars.
Well, Rob, I think the lady explained herself.
I'm not going to take advice from a haircut.
I think she explained herself perfectly. I think the water is going to be turned on when they get around to it. But in Pittsburgh, the water is not turned on, and they usually do it in the month of April.
Can we get a follow-up question there, Herb?
I think the lady's explained everything she wants.
If I have to teach you how to be a reporter.
Well, yeah, I used to be your boss once.
Yeah, and what happened with that?
That's improvisational theater, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Do you remember,
it's what we're becoming known for again.
Yay. There is something, Mike, that we have talked about in the past, but it just recently celebrated its 50th anniversary.
50th.
Do you remember in Oregon when they had to blow up the whale?
Yeah, and I think if you have the whole clip, it is one of the funniest. It's just hysterical because they show, what's it, 70s, 80s probably?
It is 50 years ago, so 73, I think.
73, dead whale washes up on the beach in Oregon, and, well, you've
well,
got
the all the right. All the comments are, we couldn't push it into the water because it's too big, and we can't cut it up because no one wants to.
Right.
So they put, Mike, how many cases of dynamite under it? 20. And the reason I'm playing this anniversary is that Oregon has another whale on the beach. But since this happened, it's illegal to blow up whales. So they're signing a petition to do it again.
Because it, like, crushed a car.
Well, you can see and hear in this video the hunks of whale fat landing around. Keep in mind, there was spectators. Lots of spectators.
Yeah, because it was a big deal. And they put the dynamite on one side of the whale.
Yes.
Thinking they were going to blow it out to the sea.
Anyway, let's just watch a little of this classic footage, courtesy of a local Oregon news outlet.
Dynamite was buried primarily on the leeward side of the big mammal, so as most of the remains would be blown toward the sea. About 75 bystanders, most of them residents who had first found the whale to be an object of curiosity before they tired of its smell, were moved back a quarter of a mile away.
Go to the
dunes. The sand dunes there were covered with spectators and land blubber newsmen, shortly to become land blubber newsmen, where the blast blasted blubber beyond all believable bounds.
20
believable
cases. Bounds. Now here's the countdown. One. Now listen, listen for the blubber landing.
All right, Fred, you can take your hands out of your ears.
That's the sound of hunks of whale.
Oh, it's so nasty.
Well, we wish the people of Oregon all the best, Mike. I hope they're able to get rid of their current whale.
Oh, my God.
There is 548 signatures on the petition.
To blow it up?
To blow it up. That's it. Well, 548.
We and can send them three more. I think
number 548 is me, as I just signed up.
And send a, you know, send a real notable TV personality. It's too late for Geraldo. He doesn't do that anymore. But send somebody.
Who would be best? Yeah. Don Lemon?
Yeah, Ryan Seacrest. He's hosting Wheel of Fortune now.
Wait a second. Can we actually use the dynamite to blow up Ryan Seacrest? Is that possible?
Fun. Have him stand on the whale. Wee!
You know, let's close with this, Mike. We talked about earlier in the week that if you take the name of a city and add it to sort of a obscure noun, it sounds like a sex act, right?
Okay.
But this is a name that is something else. Salute to Florida from Seth Myers.
A Florida man was arrested while allegedly walking around his neighborhood fully nude, or as that's also known, a Tampa tuxedo.
It's a Tampa tuxedo, Mike.
Hey, Josh, there's a guy that a murderer down here just got convicted on tomorrow's
show. You want to get him on the show?
yeah, right. Let's book him. You got to look at this dude. I'll show him tomorrow on the bonus show. We got a brand new bonus show coming up tomorrow on the Mike O'Mara Show. I want to thank our author, Ronald Drabkin. The book is Beverly Hills Spy. Simple title, fascinating story. Great summertime read. We appreciate him.
Available
coming on the show.
Where all books are sold, Mike.
Where our books are sold or all books are
Come
sold?
Come on, man. Help me out here.
I'm sorry.
Yes,
we'll
to
see
both.
You tomorrow for Rob Spiewak and Josh Soroka. This is Mike O'Mara saying, so long, everybody.
Our books are for sale.
Want more? Make sure you check out the Mike O'Mara Bonus Show. Get it at MikeOMaraShow.com.
Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment.